Welcome to Wizard Team, a Black Magical podcast for Black Magical stories. Hi everyone, it's Bayana and Portia embarking on a journey through the many fantasy stories written by and about Black people. Today, we're really excited to be joined by Brittany N. Williams, author of the second book of the Forge and Fracture saga, Saint Seducing Gold. Hi, Brittany.
Hello.
To start us off, would you mind briefly telling the audience what Saint Seducing Gold is all about?
Yeah, so the entire Forge and Fracture saga follows 16-year-old Joan Sands. She has the magical ability to manipulate metal, and she only wants to use those powers to build swords and choreograph fights for William Shakespeare's acting company. But when malevolent fae invade London, she discovers that these iron powers make her one of the few people who can protect the city from this new threat. So book one, she's just kind of discovering everything that's going on, figuring out why the Fae are suddenly invading and attacking people all over the city. She gets directly involved when one of the more powerful Fae attempts to get William Shakespeare and another actor, Richard Burbage, to murder each other on stage, and she has to step in. So book one is all about her kind of figuring out what's going on. Book two, Joan is much stronger with her magic. She has a better understanding of what's happening. And she's pretty confident that she can handle things going in until she gets pulled into the royal court of King James I. And it's a place where her newfound confidence in her physical abilities isn't much use to her because she can't really square up with the king and the people of the royal court. So it's all about her trying to figure out how to navigate all of these new conflicts, how to continue to protect people from the Fae. And an enemy she makes in book one, Robert Cecil, who is the king's spymaster and secretary of state, he in particular has it out for Joan. One, because he hates magic users, and two, because he's just a hater.
He's the worst.
He's so bad. He really is. I'm like, man. And it's like, and he is the one person that she can't just like bust in the face.
Oh, right.
What do you look like? Just a regular girl popping the Secretary of State in the mouth. Like, you can't do that, Joan. So
he deserves it, but.
Yeah.
I need to know Joan's chart. Because I know, like, we see her celebrate her birthday in this book. So we know she's like a Capricorn.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I need to know the rest. I'm like, what's her, what is her that fighting energy? Like, it feels a little bit like fire sign.
I don't know. I'm like, what would her, I know, like, of course she's a Capricorn. Her rising, I don't know. I feel like her moon might be an Aries because she's like, nuck if you buck, bruh. Maybe she might have some Cancer somewhere in her chart. Because she does get very in her feelings.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm trying to, maybe her Mars is in Aries.
Maybe. Mm. Yeah, that would be the real fighting spirit right there.
Yep, yeah, that's it. So
that's exactly. Right? Like her initial reaction is like, can I fight? I can't fight. Right. What do I do? I can't fight. She gets like turned up, torn up, because she's like, I can't. Yes. What do I do?
Right. Hands first, questions later. So, yep. I gotta do.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. You're fine. I'm working on, so I'm editing book three right now to turn in on Monday. Child is alive. But.
Congrats, though.
Thank you. Once I finish that, maybe I'll sit down and do like, that'll be fun. I'll put out her chart. I'll put out James's chart. We already know Shakespeare's a Taurus, so yeah, I'll do some, that'll be fun doing some charts. Yeah.
Rose and also Nick would be fun
Nick,
too.
So as the sequel to that selfsame metal, you had the task of expanding the world building that was already established in the first book. Were there any new inspirations or influences that you brought in that you maybe didn't touch on as much in book one?
Yeah, so it was really fun to deal more with the royal court and the Palace of Whitehall and specifically King James, chaotic bisexual that he was. We didn't see him pretty much at all in book one. At most, we saw, like, the queen and her ladies. So it was really fun to include more of him, include even more, like, historical figures. So most of the, just about everybody, no, everybody we meet at court was an actual person who lived back then. So it was fun to kind of weave those people in more, to figure out what other plays I was going to bring in and how to keep the King's Men and, like, Shakespeare and all these characters we love from book one, how to keep them in the mix, even though Joan is so separated from all of her loved ones. And just to make everything, just to let everything escalate, make, you know, the interludes a bit more scary, make the fights more daring, show that Joan has gotten better, but so have her enemies and all of that. So it was, those were the challenges. But what I appreciated was book one kind of lays the foundation, so I don't have to do all of that, like, minutia of world building again. Mm-hmm. I just have to give us a recap, make sure everybody's on the same page at the start of the book, and then we just hit the ground running. And book two, actually, the start of book two overlaps a little bit with the end of book one, so that was really fun to do as well.
Yeah, like, talking about the story building, world building aspect, though this series has historical inspiration, the England that you've crafted is one of, like, myth and mystery, which is thanks in a large part to the influence of both the Fae and the Orisha. Mm-hmm. How difficult was it for you to strike a balance between what can be seen as a blessing or a boon to some, but actually be a pressure to the holder with both that mortal court and also the Fae court?
Yeah, it was actually easier than you would think, because this period in time, like, the people who lived in England in the late 1500s, early 1600s, the supernatural was very real to them. You had a king who was a fanatical witch hunter. Like, King James believed in witchcraft. He believed he could, like, suss out witches and possessions and everything. He wrote an entire book called The Demonology about, like, identifying witches and magic users and stuff. So it wasn't, that part was easy to, the magic was easy to weave in because there was already a belief in it at that time. When it came to deciding what was considered a blessing and what was considered a burden to people, I leaned into the religious conflicts of the period. There was a lot of back and forth between Catholicism and Protestantism, thanks to Henry VIII, like, splitting from the Catholic Church so he could divorce his first wife. There was always this huge conflict between the Catholics and the Protestants. Yeah, so... And it was things like you could be taken to jail if you didn't go to church on Sunday. You had to go to, like, the right church. If you wore any of the accoutrements of Catholicism, you could also get in trouble. So considering these were people who, within the same religion, were so protective of their particular practices, that helped to guide integrating these other, like, supernatural elements and bringing in Orisha worship on top of everything else.
Yeah, I think what was captivating to me, well, so I just want to give a moment. So you might have noticed, I think this was in reaction to a hashtag SSF campaign or whatever that was done, like, last year. For our Wizard Team account, we chose, like, one of our baddies was Hearn.
Yes.
And that was very much me. That was very much me because I like dark people and dark things.
Yes.
And so it was so funny to me. I was like, as I read the book, I was like, is this Hearn? Because it was, like, not completely, like, clear. Mm-hmm. If it was her or not, I was like, why have I not seen her in a while? Like, what's happening? Yeah. And then
I wrote that for you. I was like, now, because at first I was like, oh, she's going to be, like, scary and stuff. And I was like, now I got to make her, like, a baddie for real. Like, she has to be a scary baddie. So I wrote that scene for you. I did.
When you were talking earlier about having the interludes like with darkness, and I was like, oh, and they like there's a level of like horror and not quite full on gore, but it's a decent amount of like
it gets a little gore.
Yeah.
It gets
in there. I was thinking about like how like this period, like especially like later on in the book, like that's full out gore, but like the interludes themselves, they're not like they're touching on it, right? They're not really going, they're not sitting in it the way that like you do until the tour to the end of the book, right?
That's
very dwelling in the time period. Darkness.
That's
okay,
great.
It's great. But like the thinking about like that groundingness in the like the horror of the time period itself. Like it, there's so much about like romanticizing like the time period, romanticizing like, oh, this is a time of like where people were like gallant and like we had like all these different like royal social like things that people like had to work in a certain way, and like this is how nobility had to act. And that's, it was very interesting seeing you play with that, with not only the darkness and the horror and the gore parts, but also like there's a point in the story where Joan is told that women have more power at court than they do within the theater community. And why was it important for you to kind of like point that out at some point in the story, that like, yeah, let's ground, like, yeah, we're going to ground it in the gore and the like viscera of the period. We're also going to ground it in like the, like things aren't cute even within artist communities where it's supposed to be free. Like it's not cute here either.
We always hear about how like powerless women were back in like throughout history, like, oh, you know, women couldn't do anything. They couldn't do this. They couldn't do that. And when you start to really investigate that, you see that there are always exceptions to that, like, rule or expectation. You'll find, like, widows could own their own businesses. And if you had enough money, then you could do whatever you wanted. If you had enough power, you could almost do whatever you wanted. We always hear about how there were no women on the stage in Shakespeare's time, which is true for the acting companies, but it wasn't true at like the court, where the queen and her ladies always did like these elaborate performances in these gorgeous like costumes and stuff. So I really wanted to bring that out. And ultimately this series is about making people like question the things we've been told about history. When we're told, you know, it was all white people in England at this time, I want people to be like, no, that wasn't true. And I know because of this. When they're like, oh, women were never involved in the theater in that time. You'd be like, I know that they worked backstage, and I know that they did this, and I know that they did this because of this book. I know that they performed at court because of this book. I just want to challenge all of those patriarchal, patriarchal white supremacists things we are fed all throughout like our school careers and stuff. So I'm inspired by the way Watchmen made everyone look up the Tulsa massacre. I also want to, like, through popular culture, through sci-fi and fantasy, I want people to question these missing parts of history. So
yeah, I think it's very biting in a way, like like knowing that, like, again, like I was saying, like, it's like an artist community. Jane feels it's a place of like comfort and warmth for her to go to this community. But the place that she's told she feels the most insecure about being within is the place where she supposedly has more power. So it's something very biting about that for her character, where she's like, you actually have more power in the place that you like dread, because there's more there.
Right. So, and if she wasn't like fight first, it would probably be less scary for her.
And it's also like she finds that she has at least one friend-ish in a very high place. And like talking about things that are like both a gift and both a boon and a burden, like that is a huge one. And even then she can't be sure how far that proxy power extends for her. And especially when dealing with like Robert Cecil and this other person who decides that he wants to bust all up in her life. She's not sure how she can wield this new political power to kind of fight those people off. So it's rough. I wanted to go into book two and take everything she had learned in book one, all of the power she had built up, to take that and put her in a situation where none of that matters. So
that it feels that you can feel it.
Just kind of going off briefly what you're just talking about in terms of like kind of repainting or reorienting people's thoughts about like history and who was there. Was there anything like in doing your research that like surprised you or that you kind of like thought was true and then went deeper and it just kind of like opened up, you know?
There absolutely was. So I went into this fully believing the lie of no women being involved in the theater in this time. And I happened upon a book called Labor's Lost, and it was all about how women were involved in the early modern English theater and how, you know, there were women who owned stock in the theater companies, women collected money at the front gates at the theaters, women were dressers backstage, they maintained the costumes and stuff. So in my first draft of that self-same medal, there were far fewer women involved in the periphery. And when I read that book, I immediately went back to my draft and like a bunch of these side characters who had been men. I was like, there's no need for y'all to be here. Bye. Y'all are being replaced with women. So I was very happy to do that. And I'm always happy to have my my preconceptions challenged like that in such a wonderful way. And to see some part of me reflected in history in a way that it hadn't been up until then. So it was nice. I was very excited. And then that's how we got the character Roz, who I keep writing her in all over the place because she's just great. You know? She's
it's always good to have someone who just like kind of like is in a corner like, hey.
Right.
How are you doing? Like, we're checking. What's going on?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You doing okay, baby? Here, have a juice. Like just somebody to right.
Yep.
So
yeah, I love that. I love like those things where you're like, I want to put this here, but I don't know if I can. And then you're like, oh, I can. Mm-hmm. Great. Let's just
right.
put it all on there. It's mm-hmm. great.
Yeah. And anytime I can add more women to a book, I'm like, perfect. It's like, get out of here, man.
No one cares about you. Boo.
Move, dude. Y'all had enough.
That you happen to be king, because otherwise.
Right. You don't have to be here. It's fine.
If you were dead at this time, point in time, dead.
Yeah. Yep.
So also one, this is like something that kind of struck me reading the first book and then again in this one, because there's obviously like this really big trope, like in to the point now where it's like kind of a joke about how like in YA fantasy main characters either have at least one dead parent most of the time too, or they're mm-hmm. like gone, or even if they have them, they're like really not involved, don't know what's going mm-hmm. on, you kind of like. And so, like, just not present, I guess. But that's not the case for Joan. And, like, she has her parents, but then she also has, like, these other adults who are looking out for her and who are very active in the plot. And so I was curious, like, was that, like, a conscious decision? Or did it just kind of, like, happen that way? And then you were like, oh, okay, I'll build it out more. And then why did that kind of become important for Joan to have those, like, that, like, adult support?
Yeah, so it was a conscious decision to keep her parents alive and then to have her, to have the adults in the King's Men be in these like mentorship, very supportive roles. The reason that in young people's literature, the parents are usually neglectful or dead is because if you have responsible parents, they're going to want to know what their kids are doing, and it's less mm-hmm. likely that the main characters can go off and do these like amazing, dangerous things. As I got to book three, I'm like, oh, I got a lot of responsible adults looking out for Joan. That's making things hard. But we gonna make it. So for me, my mom died when I was a baby. So I wanted Joan to have both of her parents be alive to just kind of write that and see how that felt. I infused all of the adults with energies from the different adults that have helped to raise me. So, you know, the King's Men are all infused with like the adults that took me under their wing throughout my theater career. Joan's parents are, you know, anybody who has claimed me as their child. So like my aunts and my uncles, my grandparents, like all of their characteristics are infused into into them. And it just felt really lovely to write. And I thought it was a good challenge to see if I could have Joan do dangerous and oftentimes irresponsible things while she had these like active loving parents who are looking out for her. So, and they're also like in the mix, like all of these adults are ready to like throw, they are ready to throw down at a moment's notice. So it's been fun to have this, like, we have like to play around with the chosen one trope, but also have this very active army of support around her. I think it was a tweet where somebody was like, if you don't have cousins, who helps you jump people? Like, I'm like, Joe has a crew to help her jump. Like, they begging people out here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been, I enjoyed the challenge of writing live, active, caring adults. And I just thought it was, I thought it was fun. I love them. I love her parents.
Yeah. No, they're so great. And it's like, I just remember being like, oh, okay. It's not just like, even though they're active, it's not like they're like, you know, obviously to an extent, it's like, okay, Joan, you don't need to be doing this. I'm trying to like protect you. But then there's also a sense of like, oh, we're already here. Mm-hmm. Great. Let's like, we're going to just handle this together. And so like, let's throw down. I got it. Mm-hmm. And so I just love that because it's not something that you see very often.
Mm-hmm. And I love her mom. Her mom is so great. She's so fabulous.
Her mom literally comes through swinging. Like, she just comes through swinging. Like, whenever you see her, like, okay. So it's funny that we're saying, like, where is the fight in Joan's chart? But it's like, she got it from her mama. Like, it's that's the answer. She just got it from her mama. It's what it is. And it's hilarious because how they butt heads, it's like, Joan is like, I gotta go fight somebody. Her mom was like, do you? But she's like, and she's like, who are you talking to? Like, I'm
right.
I learned it from you.
Right. I learned it watching you, okay? And it's that they butt heads in that way that like mothers and daughters who are very similar kind of like as a parent myself, sometimes I see some of my less admirable habits pop up in my child and I'm like, oh, yep, I know exactly what that is. And I don't like it. I'm looking in the mirror and I hate it. So.
Thanks, I hate it.
Can we please?
Can you not?
Can we not?
Can we?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is so fun. And it's fun in the story. Like, it really comes, like, in the story, when those moments happen, you're like, ooh. I mean, I don't know who's going to win in this one. If I know who's going to feel like they won, but I don't know if that's going to be that's going to win the battle, but not lose the war. I don't know if that's going to. How it's gonna pan out for everyone there, which is really funny. Generally, this was something that we've noticed, and I think this is especially true because we've been interviewing, you know, Black folk, like Black stories, is that like we see, we've been speaking to different authors in our interviews and noticing that there's like this emphasis put on moving within community, like they're having the characters who move in community kind of like have better things happen for them than the ones who choose like an individualistic focus. And during a point of tension within Saint Seducing Gold, we see Joan choose the protection of one community to her immediate strain over actually going to kind of like enjoy and be joyful with another community that she belongs to like restore her energy and like make like give her a boost before she goes on to something. What do you hope readers gain from seeing her make this sort of decision where she's like, her immediate needs are not met, but she's doing it for the community. She's like going through that effort for the community. And then like what that means sort of like for Joan's character arc, but also generally like what readers could take from that.
I really want readers to come away with more grace for themselves when they make decisions in the moment that may seem like the right one, but in hindsight wasn't the best choice or the most healthy choice. I want them to see like all of Joan's faults and mistakes and all of the ways that she chooses poorly and see how she's still like loved and cared for and cherished and sometimes triumphant, sometimes not, but like how she's still, how that doesn't destroy her. And I know, I remember as a teenager, every mistake I made felt so enormous. And I wasn't dealing with anything nearly as bad as Joan is. So I want them to, I want readers to come away with, hopefully with a permission to make mistakes and to learn, and to move through fear, and to not judge yourself if you can't move through that fear in the moment, and to know that you can lean on community. I really want this series to show the benefit of leaning on your community versus trying to like tough something out on your own. It's a hard lesson to learn sometimes, especially yeah. because everything in our society tells us like to be individualistic. Like you need to look out for yourself. You need to look out for number one. We don't owe each other anything. Nobody owes you anything. I really want to challenge that because I think particularly folks who move in communities of color, we can see explicitly how that is untrue. We are our strongest and we are most loving when we exist within community, when we lean on each other. Life feels most beautiful when your neighbors feel like family, when you, like, whether it's blood family or found family, when we're together, life feels its most beautiful. So,
yeah. I love that. It's very poetic. Yeah. Without you being a poet, it was very poetic. what you were saying there, and then what is joy if joy is not felt? Like you're not sharing it. Like mm-hmm. if you don't share and joy, is it if it's like contained? Is it fully like realized? It doesn't really feel mm-hmm. that way. Yeah. Cool. Love that. Here on Wizard Team, it's no surprise that we love books. We also love supporting the independent bookstores.
With our bookshop affiliate link, you can not only get all the books on your TBR, but you can support indie bookstores and BNC at the same time.
And if you're not sure what you want, that ain't no problem. Check out our The Plot Thickens list full of recommendations from none other than Portia herself.
Head to www.bookshop.org/shop/blacknerdscreate to treat your shelves.
Treat your shelves.
Oh, that's nice. That's clever.
Oh my goodness.
That's clever.
Going on the other side of the coin, sort of, there are many, many dastardly characters in this story and in the world of yes. this series. I have two questions. One, who is your favorite villain to write so far? And then what do you enjoy the most about writing villains?
Oh, man. I really liked writing Auberon in book one because he is his own, like, baddie with a bad plan. I feel like it's a spoiler. Close your ears if you haven't finished book one. Close your ears. Close your ears for the next, like, close your ears and count to 10. And starting now. So Titania is my favorite baddie to write. Like, I love her. I adore her. She is so scary because you can't be sure of her movement at any given moment. And it's that, like, you know, the person who, it's like, it feels a little Regina Georgie where you want to be around this like powerful person, this powerful mean girl, but she can turn on you at any moment. So what do you do with that? And just trying to like gauge her movements, like what is her plan? How does she operate? Like, you know, when you're in her favor, it's wonderful. When you're not, it's terrible. So yeah, I think she's my favorite. Robert, y'all can listen again. Spoiler over. Welcome back. thank you so much for taking that break. Robert Cecil is, I enjoy writing him, but I hate him. I hate him so much. I hate him. And he wasn't a very nice person in real life. But you know, he worked himself to death in the real world. I hate him, love writing him. And what I love writing about villains is, I like writing something, and then once I finish writing it, I sit back and I'm like, ooh, that's terrible. That's bad. It's like, all right, we're in it. We in the pocket. Like anything, like whenever I write a baddies move and it makes me pause and be like, damn, that's rough. Like, I'm like, yep, we got it. And also on top of like, on top of, with everybody, I didn't do this with Robert Cecil because like, you know, fuck, forget that guy. But with the Fae in particular, I wanted to put in some like shades of moments where you're like, okay, but are they wrong though? Like, is this, is this as black and white as we're thinking? So that's what I wanted to layer in for the Fae baddies. But Robert Cecil, you don't get no shades. You're just terrible.
He's the worst. No, I love that about the Fae too, because it's like, you're trying to figure out what they want, but you're also trying to figure out if what they want is bad. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, now we're fighting. And so it seems like it's bad because there's a lot of blood and a lot of gore happening here. But then, well, still, we don't really know what they want. Like, maybe we should hear them out. Like, I don't know. Like, it's very like,
yeah. And it's so easy. In fantasy, we so often see this like war between peoples, where the human side is the good side and the non-human side is the bad side. And usually the non-human side is coded as, you know, coded like people of color. And I really wanted to avoid that easy racist narrative when it comes to this. So, and also this idea that like all of the Fae are bad because they are Fae. All of the humans are good because they are human. We know that that is not true of anyone, anything. So it's been fun to like weave those aspects into the story.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to flipping the coin over again in this question, but my thought right now is again hinting towards that interlude towards the end of the book, where the gore is very prominent and we're inside the Fae's point of view.
Yeah. And
that was like, it was a very, for me, that was very fun because it was like aspect where you're like, are the Fae the bad people here in a situation? Mm-hmm. Like, you're actively seeing humans be the perpetrators of torture.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And a Fae is enjoying the torture, but it's torture that was made by humans. He's not he's not the actor. He's just the person who is kicking up his heels and enjoying what's happening in front of him. And to me, that was like, that was just like a really fun like headspace to be in. And I'm occupied for a moment because it's like, I love staying in morally gray spaces, but that's not even like morally gray. That's just like, what is like, what do you, should judgment be passed? What are we doing? Like, the judgment should be passed on the Fae in this moment? Should be passed? Mm-hmm. I would put the judgment on the people who are acting and not on the person who's like
dealing with it all. That was a really fun interlude to write. And every bit of gore that's included in that is true to history. And true to what actually happened to those people involved in that situation. So it, like, to your point, you know, we have this incredible, one of the most horrific moments probably in all of the books. And it's perpetrated completely and joyfully and publicly by humans. And seeing it through the eyes of the Fae and this being who's capable of really, really terrible acts, and just seeing them like watch this and acknowledge it, it lets you be a little disconnected from the emotion of it, or to like inspect it in a different way. And especially because this particular Fae is part of the Wild Hunt, and the Wild Hunt are the ones that like in book one was just snatching people off the streets, and it's like often described as this like cloud of nightmarish beings that ride around following the commands of a noted baddie, Herm the Hunter. So that was really fun to write, to kind of think about what one of the Wild Hunt being a spectator at a public execution would look like. So
I'm glad you put it in, because I was like, I didn't know I needed this, but what? Oh.
Because
the setup of how we get there, I was like, oh, I'm not enjoying this at all.
It's so stressful. I was going to say
the flip. Yeah. I was going to say the flip was really great, because it was like, I don't really want to, do I want to read this in this way? And then it switches and you're like, oh, interesting. Like, this is just different perspectives and how that can like shift how you take in information is really like. Yeah.
Sometimes the interludes come in as a bit of relief. Like, especially in moments where Joan's stress is through the roof and mm-hmm. we are right there with her, the interlude will pop in and give us like a different perspective. So especially towards the end of book two. So there's that one. And I think the next interlude is also like a moment where we can step back from what's going on with Joan and all of her high stress, get into somebody else's head, but then it launches us right back into like, oh my God, what are we doing? why? It's like, why is this happening? So shout out to William Cecil for being absolutely wretched. Ugh. Y'all will see. And like, we saw him in book one. We see him in book one mm-hmm. very differently. I do like love triangles a little bit. My preference is always end game to be OT3. I'm mm-hmm. like, why separate the group? Like, let all three of them be together. So, of course, Joan has Nick on one side and Rose on the other side. I already told the whole internet that endgame is OT3, so they're going to figure something out. And then we have this other person present himself as a suitor for Joan, William Cecil from book one, and things go very differently.
Yeah, that is, like, I feel like, it's so funny because we did not give you these questions ahead of time like we tried to do, but you really just leapt right on to right into it.
We are in sync. We got it.
That was a great transition.
It really is. So, as you just said, that is Joan is not only trying to navigate like all these like tumultuous, like stressful moments with the Fae and the court and all like the human court and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. She's also trying to navigate her burgeoning feelings for two different people, Nick and Rose. And you have talking about like made them a true triangle OT3. Why did you want to make sure that this series had a true triangle? And what is your favorite thing about their dynamic? But also, why did you undercut this like burgeoning triangle with this like hater and junior tagging along?
Hater in training.
Right.
So I, like I said, like whenever I read like fan fiction and stuff, and I always lean towards like OT3. Fix. It's just where I love it.
Is it a triangle if it's not three? Like, I don't understand.
Right.
We talk about hinges all the time. Like, I don't want a hinge. You know? I want a triangle.
Yeah. Yep. So, well, we at least got the point. So we got this side. We still got to figure out how they're going to connect or if they're going to connect. But I really wanted to, I don't know. As I was writing book one and I wrote, like, I wanted to openly show Joan attracted to a woman, attracted to a man. And as I was writing both Nick and Rose, I was like, I don't think I can choose one of them. So why does she have to choose? And we often, I feel like also in that time period, we get these examples of people who are openly in relationships outside of their marriages. So we see that with William Shakespeare and all of these like assumptions of like, oh, well, he must have had the Dark Lady and there must have been this like young, beautiful young man he was writing the sonnets about. Meanwhile, his wife is at home taking care of the kids and just wondering if that dynamic could have been consensual, could have been like less of infidelity, more of an open relationship. Mm-hmm. And so using that to make that kind of relationship common in the world of the Forge and Fracture saga. We even see a moment with Joan's parents in book one and somebody who rolls by the house who they're like, you know what? Cool. If you know, you know. I don't think some of the young readers who read that part know what's going on, but all the adults are like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So I leaned into that and I thought it would be fun and it was a perfect opportunity to have a three person relationship in like a book for teens. And what was especially important to me throughout was to show explicit consent with things. Mm-hmm. And my editor emphasized that we need to make sure that Joan is being ethically non-monogamous. So a lot of the tropes we see in love triangles where it's like, oh, you know, she kissed this person and the next she kissed that person, like trying to not not leaning into some of the familiar tropes, because when you really inspect them, you're like, that's actually being a terrible partner. This isn't the way you go about a healthy relationship. So pulling those parts out and then presenting William Cecil as this like extreme contrast, and to show that even though Joan, Nick, and Rose are considering this open relationship in a way, it's still closed to, you know, other people. It's like, okay, I can accept this. I can accept that. Not this.
Not that.
Yeah. Not him. Not him. That guy.
Not him. Ever.
Right.
Not
that. Like, no. And Joan doesn't even like him, so.
You're right. You know. She's like, please get him out of here. Like, yeah. I'm sorry. This is spoiler. We probably got to cut it. When she tells that man to his face, get your son. I don't want nothing to do with him.
Right.
Yep. I am repulsed by him. I would rather he die. I don't want anything to do with him. And he looks back at his son like Kay surprised, because how dare he like this black girl?
Right.
It's hilarious to me. But she just finally popped off and was like, I gotta say it. Right. I was gonna say it.
I don't even like him.
She was fed up. Fed the fuck up. But also, like, by that point, we were fed up too. Like, get him out of here.
My favorite thing is to be like, a different world where, what is her name? Oh my gosh, Diane Carroll. Whenever she's playing with Lee's mom, when she says "die, just die," like I just feel bad for character sometimes. I'm just like,
yep. So to get back out of the spoiler section,
yeah.
What I also really wanted to show with William Cecil was that the way we see men wield their social power in these really ugly ways,
mm-hmm.
And just you know, this show the reflections of his father in like a worse, a less savvy version of his dad, the spy master. Like he knows what power he has access to, and he kind of knows how to wield it, but really he just doesn't know what's going on for real. So I had fun writing that aspect, but it's another person, like the Cecil family, man, aside from Francis, they could just get on up out of here.
Like, yeah, I was like, dang, all of you, look, Ralph, wow. I was like, oh, maybe he'll be cool. It'll be a,
Nothing in the first book prepared me for him to be as awful.
No.
As he
yeah. And it was, I know. Nobody was prepared.
He's really like his son's, he's really his father's son. Like, mm-hmm. We talked about Joan being her mother's daughter. He is straight up and down his father's son.
Yep.
And dressed in all black like the Omen. Mm-hmm. So,
for real. Like a Puritan.
Yes. Man, I feel like you can read the book and you can feel, you can be like, okay, the Fae might have a point. Like, Oberon might have had a point sometimes, like, you know, her and the Hunter baddie, like, y'all all baddies, yes. But when you get to Robert Cecil and William Cecil, there's like, not like, I wanted people to read the book, and I didn't want anybody to come away being like, okay, but you know, enemies to lovers with William Cecil. Like, no. Nope,
absolutely not.
No. No. She, and like, when it comes to Nick and Rose, Joan, like you said, Joan is going through so much in her life. I wanted her romantic relationship to at least be like somewhat easy. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want her to go through like major struggle with them, because she got enough. It's like, you trying to save the entire country. You got, something got to be going right for you.
And yeah. Including her love interest at different points. She's trying to save both of them. She tries to
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, it's, Joan is great at fighting. Her mom got hands. You know, Shakespeare and Burbage, they can fight too. Nick is okay. James cannot fight. James got a mouth on him, but James, her twin brother, he cannot
read.
He
can read.
Yes. He is, the witch is there. Mm-hmm. The hands, not so much.
They're not.
And then Rose can fight. Like, thankfully, Rose can fight. But she, of all of the characters that are that surround Joan, I think Rose is the one with the least amount of like social and political power. So, you know, that's her own struggle that she has to deal with. So it's like Joan has the ability to protect both of her love interests, and that's often at the forefront of her mind. But it's a struggle. Stuff is dangerous.
Yeah,
people out here dropping like flies. So, yep.
So earlier, and even just now too, when talking about the Cecils, like we've talked about the duality that Joan like has to maintain caution with when dealing with both mortal and fey worlds, which mm-hmm. often lends to her practicing malicious compliance. And then in one particular passage, mm-hmm. she's described as being obedient and not compliant, and watchful, not vigilant. Mm-hmm. Joan is also unskilled at lying. So what can we expect from her in terms of like maintaining this balance as she moves forward?
Oh man. Joan wishes nothing more than she had like James in her ear, because he is an excellent actor. If they could switch places, he is built for something like this. Like he is mm-hmm. built to play the games at court. Joan is not. Like she is, one thing about, if you talk to anyone who works with Arisha contemporarily, they'll tell you that like children of Ogun are honest. They do not lie. They are like honest sometimes to a fault. And that goes with Ogun being the Arisha of like justice. And you know, you follow the law almost to the letter. Like you children of Ogun are not supposed to like run red lights. You're not supposed to like, you know, do little things to get around to like circumvent the rules. So I wanted to bring that characteristic forward with Joan. And it also goes to the idea of putting her in a situation where every strength she has is now kind of a weakness, because of, you know, where she is. And it's just like the scene where she's at court, or the scenes where she's with the Queen's ladies in book one, and they're like all in her hair, treating her like an object and an animal and a spectacle. And all she can do is like take it. I wanted to capture all of those familiar moments for Black women where we're in a situation where we have to comply for our safety and security, but we still find little ways to rebel. And so, like you said, like malicious compliance, this idea of following what you say, but putting a little disobedience underneath it. And just like, Joan is at a disadvantage, but she's still not a pushover. So she, mm-hmm. she discovers more and more ways to bring that like fight instinct out in her in ways that usually work well, but not always.
I feel like she's a pretty fast learner too. Like she has her, you know, mm-hmm. there's certain things that she struggles with, but it also feels like if she makes mm-hmm. a mistake, she's not going to make it again. It might be a different mistake, but she's like learned from mm-hmm. those things.
Yeah. And that's like, that's the aspect of the skilled fighter in her. Like you, when you're in a physical fight, you have to learn fast. Like you mm-hmm. have to pick up cues. You have to understand your opponent very quickly because fights do not last long. So yeah, she's not, our girl isn't, she's stubborn. She is rash sometimes, but she's not stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So, I love that you brought up Ogun, because the next question has to deal with him. So at one point in the story, Ogun mentions that humanity's work is to discover their part, like kind of like on Earth, like generally like in like mm-hmm. in the godly way, to figure mm-hmm. out their part. Whereas he, as a spirit, already knows his path.
Mm-hmm.
Might this be a hint that we may see the spirit or fey realm before the end of the series?
I think that's so funny because I literally have the document right here. I don't immediately have plans. See, you're about to make me write another scene just for you. Stop. I didn't have plans for that. I think you do see other, spirits in future installment or in book three. But I hadn't planned on specifically showing the Fae realm. I like that we kind of see everything happening in the mortal realm slash on this familiar plane of existence, and kind of understanding that both parties consider they feel ownership over the mortal realm and this earthly plane, and dealing with this idea of the Orisha existing, you know, in this realm beyond, and the people they've chosen as their children are the ones who carry out their works here on Earth. So we may never like see them in person, see them beyond, you know, them coming through when they possess one of their children, but we understand their desires and their works through the actions that their earthly proxies take.
Yeah, I think one of my, I guess like part of my early theories from book one was around, like, I like to know the why of things. And I'm like mm-hmm. besides the Fae feeling ownership for the mortal realm, like to an extent, why is it so like a big deal for them to have to get away from where they've been? Like, what's the problem there where they're like, nah, we need to be over here.
Yeah, it's less, I'll say this, it's less that they want to get away from there in that they want to get back to where they had access to. So all of the, you know, for all this time up until they, you know, the child of Ogun sealed that pact 1500 years before the start of that selfsame metal, all the way up until that point, the Fae just could roam freely. And all of them could roam freely, whether they intended harm for mortals or not. After the pact was sealed, it was like everyone who held a certain amount of power or just explicitly meant to harm mortals was stuck away from here. So they could see other people pass through. They could see other Fae pass through, like changelings would still come through, other beings, because like, at the start of book one, we see that like Joan acknowledges that like she's used to seeing, you know, a few of the Fae interspersed around the city, but suddenly there's this like influx of more, and they're trying to figure out why, and it's because the pact is broken. So it's less of an escape from one place to another than a return to the way things were.
Right, that makes sense.
I love it. I feel like that's a theme for a lot of the community-based storytelling is about, like, mm-hmm. communities where you find change and shift mm-hmm. and growth, and the people who are the stagnant, mm-hmm. individualistic ones are the ones who mm-hmm. tend to be stagnant and maintain status quo tend to be the individualistic, keep things how they are because mm-hmm. it works for me currently, so why would I change anything kind of people. Mm-hmm. So I see that for, like, the story being told here. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So you did mention like a couple times, obviously there's a book three, but in general, what can we expect from you next?
So, so I sold this as a trilogy. So these are all of the books that I have sold up until now. I am, as long as I hit my deadlines, fingers crossed, say a little prayer for me. Book three is set to come out next spring. And then we'll see after that. I have some ideas. I really enjoy writing historical fantasy. I think it's really fun. It's a really great way to educate people through entertainment. I love digging through history and finding lesser known figures and being able to like showcase them. I love seeing all these like weird anecdotes that you find as you start digging through history. I'm really excited to also showcase more Black people throughout history, showcase more queer people and queer stories throughout history, especially queer stories, because we are the people love erasing us from history. It's like, as much as they love erasing mm-hmm. Black people and being like, oh, you know, Black people were invented for slavery. That's it. they like to pretend that like queer people popped up in the 90s out of nowhere and that's it. So I really enjoy that aspect of writing historical pieces. And I love writing YA. I think like teens and teenagehood has so much potential. There's so much fear and bravery and change, and everything feels so huge. And looking back as an adult now, I love writing. I like writing stories to my teen self, or like writing the books that I would have loved to have picked up off the shelf. And adding more, I just want to add more Black girls on book covers for fantasy books to the canon. Like, I just want there to be, mm-hmm. And I want every like niche weird Black girl to be able to pick up a book that like, that has exactly the story she wants to read, and not like, oh, well, you know, this is close to what I want. Like, I'll read this. No, I want us all to like put out books. So whatever weird specific story you want to find, Black girl, we got it for you. So. I'm looking forward to writing more of that. As soon as I know stuff, y'all will know stuff. But yeah, all that's coming up so far is book 3 in the Forge and Fracture saga, which kind of ties up all the loose ends. Yeah, we'll see what's going on with Joan and the Fae and the Orisha, and how many people make it out alive at the end. We'll see.
Like, fatality rate historically for the series so far, it's not great. So not yeah. Great.
Well, No. The one at the end of book 2 got me, and I went back and forth. I was like, do I have to do this? I don't think I have to do this. And I was like, yeah, I gotta do this. And it's bad too. It's real bad.
Talking about visceral, it was visceral and heartrending at the same
couple,
time.
It's a couple mm-hmm. real bad ones. I'm like, yeah. Damn.
And you're okay. Right. You're looking at your I know. Like,
but that's how you know you have to keep it.
Yeah.
Like, if you're upset by it, then it's like, cool. Mm-hmm. That's perfect for the readers.
I hate killing off characters. I hate it. I hate when people do it. I hate doing it myself. But sometimes you have to. And like I said, I kind of come to a point where I'm like, Joan is surrounded by too many responsible adults. I need to, call her. So y'all, you know what? People who haven't read it yet, sorry, take that as you will. It's tough.
Brutal. It's brutal out here to be a character in someone else's world, huh?
I know, right? You caught up in a war in a YA novel. If you are over 25, your chances are slim.
Your days are numbered.
So, you can be an orphan in an orphanage and get got. So yes, it really don't matter.
Nope. Oh man, yes. Oh, that orphanage scene. It went up on. So if anybody wants to read it, it's chapter 15, and it is up for free on Reactor Magazine. I wrote that scene and I had to immediately close my laptop and shut everything down for the night. I was like, all right, that's it. No more. No, not thinking these thoughts. Nope.
Yeah, that one was wild. I was just like, oh no. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
It's real bad. My editor was like, oh my God, what is this? I was like, sorry, we gotta ramp it up.
You gotta know how bad the baddies are. It's not they're not making the stallion baddies. They're the real deal.
Yeah, it's rough. It's oof.
You could be minding your own business. That's not my main thing with the interview.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are with people who are just minding their own business and stuff happen. And I'm like, if that ain't being Black in America, but you know.
Listen. Well, the one surefire way to survive an interlude in my books is to be queer, to be gay, to be a lesbian. I don't kill any gay people. Sorry. Sorry, not sorry. We don't, there's only like one, no, I won't do that. Yeah, I try, the majority of them, 9 times out of 10, you're gonna make it out, so. I'll say like 9.5.
Really, look out for them.
Those are great eyes.
Someone has to look out for them, because that whole like bury your gaze thing, like that is ridiculous. Yeah. Like it happens too much. Yeah.
I was like, we got enough of that. Mm-hmm. They'll be in danger. Like you will be in danger.
Right.
Peril?
You will be in serious peril, but you're going to make it. Mm-hmm. You might not make it with all your limbs, but you're going to make it.
Right. You might be a little traumatized, but that's okay.
Yep. But did you die though? No.
Just wipe it up. Knock it off. Just, you know.
Just walk it off. You'd be bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Can you let our audience know where they can find you and your work?
Yes. You can find that Selfsame Metal and Saints Seducing Gold wherever you buy books. Saints Seducing Gold is out on April 23rd. So, you can buy that wherever. It's available in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. That Selfsame Metal is available in those same formats as well as in paperback. You can find me across social media at Brittany X, BRITTANYACTS. And you can find me on my website, which is BrittanyNWilliams.com, and sign up for my newsletter on Substack.
Thank you once again for joining us today for this interview. Thank you everyone who is listening. I hope you heard Brittany, when she said cover your ears, because if you are saying anything to us in a DM, so hop in her DM, so hop into her comments talking about she spoiled something for you. She told us warning.
Yes. Don't. Okay. Yeah. And you know what? Even with that little like spoiler or
I feel
maybe,
like they weren't that big.
Yeah.
It wasn't. But don't try to use it as a thing to be mad about either. Don't be a Cecil. No. Like, let's not do that.
Don't be a hater. The most he is the biggest hater. Nothing but hater energy. So,
bad vibes. We just give it everyone, so you are noticed for how to act accordingly with Brittany. Also, a note about where what's happening with Wizard Team. We're currently on hiatus for the rest of the month, but please stay tuned for our May miniseries where we'll be discussing Black Panther, The Tales of Wakanda.
Wizard Team is part of the Black Nerds Create Collective. If you want to keep up with our content, you can check out our website at blacknerdscreate.com. Follow us on Instagram and Tumblr at Wizard Team Pod and at Black Nerds Create. Bye, y'all.
Bye.